Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Welcome to this podcast series for the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. I am Ian McDuff, and I'm speaking with you from Wellington, New Zealand. And it's my pleasure to be your host for this series. As the name of the podcast indicates, this is a series of conversations in the field of online dispute resolution, from now on ODR, in which I'll meet with many of the leading pioneers and innovators in the field of digital access to justice. And today it's a personal and professional pleasure to be joined by my good colleague and friend, Leah Wigg, a good colleague and friend that we've met in person once, I think, haven't we, Leah, in Paris in 2017, but I feel as I've known you for a long time. So, Leah, welcome to this podcast and this series. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. I agree. A long friendship, very much often just online, but I look forward to the next time we meet in person. Thank you for inviting me.
That'd be great. Now, Leah, I could spend about half our podcast time running through elements of your bio, but what I'm going to do is direct any listeners of this podcast to the website of which you are one of the editors, the odr.info, I-N-F-O, /fellows. And that's where people who are interested can follow up on your bio and indeed on the bios of all the fellows. So instead of going through all the details, but for the purposes of this conversation, the important things to know about you, Leah, for listeners to know, is that you are the director of the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution at UMass in Amherst. And the name, the National Center, is a little of a misnomer because of the international scope of the fellows, but there you go. You're the co-founder and vice president and board of directors of the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution, from now on, iCoder. And again, key to our conversation, you head the Ethical Principles for Online Dispute Resolution Initiative 4 NCTDR. And you've been teaching dispute resolution for 30 years or so, I think, about that. Member of editorial boards. And what I see as I scan your bio, Leah, is a strong social justice driver. That in addition to the obvious interest in technology and dispute resolution, and because you're the founding director of the Social Justice Mediation Institute. So there's a confluence of social justice, technology, and ethics, which I think shapes this. Yeah, can I ask you a question in relation to the document that you were part of producing, the framing the parameters of ODR? And preliminary question, there are two terms that are used in that document. And for the sake of clarity, it would be good to sort those out. You talk about principles and standards. Are we talking about the same thing or different things here?
Well, Ian, let me just start off by saying, I think it's exciting to be having a conversation with you in particular on this, because you're someone who I've admired in the field for a long time as having brought an ethical lens to thinking about dispute resolution of all kinds, inside of court, outside of court, and particularly also in the ODR world. So I am excited to be having this conversation with you today.
Thank you.
And the confluence of consideration of ethics with dispute resolution, whether it is rules-based handling of disputes or needs-based handling of disputes, more relational problem solving, collaborative problem solving, is really at the core of my own interests, both as an academic and also as a practitioner. I'm a mediator and a mediation trainer. And I would say that as I began to research the history and the framing of addressing ethical issues in the field of dispute resolution in general, what's often referred to as ADR, as well as looking at how engineers, how accountants, and other fields have looked at issues around ethics, I noticed sometimes a consistency and sometimes an inconsistency in how the words are used. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly don't want to be deciding for others how they framed this. But I think one of the themes around ethics is to frame standards as rule-based, in effect, the musts. Mm-hmm. What we might consider the floor of what's acceptable. So that's different than guidance or best practices. And the way I've seen principles framed and the way I engage in the literature around this is to see principles as overarching guidance, overarching considerations to be considered. And so when I worked with others in developing the ethical principles for online dispute resolution, the goal was to provide this kind of 300,000 foot level GPS, as I refer to it in my work, that can help provide us with some guidance, either in the development of standards, or I would say that I think that standards development takes time to build consensus and to get implemented. And technology is moving far more rapidly than we can make agreement on what standards ought to be. And so I think that having a set of ethical principles can also be useful when we have new technologies that come to the fore, or we're trying to find ways to translate the ethics to our practice, that having a set of principles in addition to this kind of baseline floor of must-haves is important.
Okay, and that is so helpful. I mean, just what that does is trigger memories and probably traumas about the long conversations, the conversations from long ago about the same issues in legal practice. What used to be called legal ethics turned into standards of professional conduct. And that was the baseline, which in some instances, of course, was merely a set of guidelines as to what it was you had to do or get away with. Well, I like the idea that you have a set of overarching principles. And we can come back later, I hope, to discuss some of the specific areas of concern which you and your colleagues have raised, because I think it's a definitive but a shifting or flexible set of standards, because as you said, it's always a work in progress. But one of the other things that is at the heart of your conversations and what I've seen of your work and the framing the parameters document is the word risk and the fact that you are addressing emerging risks in this field. Could you say a bit about what those risks are and how the standards address those risks?
Let me say two things to begin my response around that. One is that I find the discussion about ethics incredibly exciting and important because it can encourage us to look at what we can be doing to help live up to the things that practitioners want to live up to. For example, we want to be able to heal human relationships. We want to be able to create avenues through which collaboration could lead to problem solving and conflict transformation. We want to see access to justice and the implementation of rules and laws in a fair way, both procedurally and substantively. Mm-hmm. And when we have a set of ethical standards, they can help us to see, especially when we're adding something new, which is taking a look at how technology is related to dispute resolution, and incorporating them into dispute resolution ethics, it gives us the opportunity to actually magnify our capabilities. So I don't see ethics and the discussion around ethics as only about risk, but I do think that that's an important component. So one thing I wanted to highlight the positive that I think it helps us to increase what we'd like to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And then the other is that I also think it is not just theoretical and about being a moral practitioner or a moral system designer. It's really about practice. And so with that as a backdrop, I'll jump in more deeply into your question about risk. I do think that adding technology to our dispute resolution processes, anywhere from using collaborative writing tools online to document exchange, to e-payment systems, to complete ODR provider systems that allow for a wide variety of activities to be accomplished inside of them, to using video, to using artificial intelligence to either generate options or actually make decisions. These are just a handful of the many forms of technology that we can harness in our practices. It raises risks to magnify inequalities that exist offline already, but it also can raise risks where there isn't inequality. Gotcha. And where there isn't the same kind of risk offline. So I think once again, I would just echo what I've said already and what you've said, which is that having a set of standards can be useful for people who want to reduce the risk for everyone, including for third parties, and especially for the most vulnerable populations who will be participating in our processes as we use technology.
Yeah, that was perfect. I mean, just I'm so helpful to hear you articulate it that way, and also to emphasize that while risks are maybe what provoke the development of the standards, that's not all we're talking about. We're also talking about opportunities here, and opening up a whole array of opportunities. One of the issues that drives us, one of the ideas that drives us, is something you've just mentioned, which is access to justice. And in a way, that becomes a kind of overarching value, doesn't it, in terms of what you've suggested, and something that Ethan discussed in the conversation I had with him in our first conversation. Something also that you've mentioned, not just now, but in the framing document, is that it's the nature of ADR and of at least non-court-based ODR that has been removed from the standard supervisory bodies. It's moved away from the courts. Is that a consideration when framing the standards, that we don't have the protection of the institutional frameworks when we're moving in ADR and at least most aspects of ODR?
That's really interesting the way you've framed that, Ian. I think it resonates, it makes sense. I think there's a gap there. And one of the things that's most exciting and most disorienting, perhaps we could say, about technology is that it's a disruptor. It's a disruptor of boundaries. Mm-hmm. It's a disruptor of the norms. And so if we look at dispute resolution ethics or standards of practice, most of them have not caught up with the incorporation of technology at all whatsoever, whether it's about security and the use of technology, about the use of data, about data mining, about transparency with what dispute resolution processes are, how we're harnessing technology and dispute resolution processes around liability, mm-hmm. for AI bias, a wide variety of things that our dispute resolution standards don't address these issues. Sure. And so our hope as the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution and the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution collaborated to develop these most recent batch of standards in 2022, we were interested in addressing that gap. And while we frame it as ODR standards, frankly, even prior to the disaster of COVID, many people were starting to use technology, even if they didn't realize that what they were doing could be termed by many as ODR. Mm-hmm. And now certainly with COVID and the people's response to the pandemic in the ADR and the court community, people have started to use technology. And so we really would hope that people would consider the ODR standards as supplemental. We're not seeking to replace other important standards of ethical practice, either in court or in ADR, but the desire is to fill the gap and maybe to encourage people to see that so much of what we're doing already is considered ODR.
Can I touch on something you just raised, which is the impact of the pandemic, which of course is still afflicting most of us 2.5 years later. as you'll be aware in the States, and certainly from here in New Zealand, where distance is one of our considerations, people found that they had to start, mediators had to move online if they wanted to carry on practicing. Most of those practitioners have discovered that actually practicing online is not the terrible thing that they expected it would be. But they're also haven't been part of the conversation that you and I and our ODR colleagues are part of. They are now people who have almost coincidentally become part of the ODR community. How could you imagine capturing their attention to draw their attention to these standards? Many will, of course, abide by the standards of their mediation professional, a legal professional, or social welfare, social work. I mean, something you just said triggered this puzzle for me. How do we capture their attention to the standards which you and your colleagues are now dealing in the ODR field specifically? Because they probably don't see themselves as part of the ODR field. They just happen to be practicing online.
Right. And I guess for me, I hope that as people who care about problem solving and being part of that, that when they become aware either of some dilemmas as they incorporate technology, or when they become aware that other people are discussing that, they will see that it can be useful to take a look at the standards as a way to provide them with guidance about decision-making. So let me try to move to a concrete example regarding
that. Thank you.
As a mediator, I might hand out in a face-to-face dispute resolution process an agreement to mediate form.
Yep.
Where I might at this point, even prior to the pandemic, be used to sending a copy over email. And then people sign it and bring it to our face-to-face session and say, I agree that you're my mediator and I understand the process. So what protocol do I need to change, if at all, if we're going to meet over video conferencing? What protocol do I need to include, for example, should I tell them what forms of technology I plan to have us engage with ahead of time? And if I do, which I think relates to the issue of transparency and accessibility, then as part of my protocol as a mediator, how familiar do I need to be with not only how to use each process, but how to teach others to use the process? Because teaching about technology is different than serving as a mediator or an arbitrator, just as an example. And so I think here's just an example. I think there's a possibility that there will be a new aspect of our profession where people are providing technical support to dispute resolvers who are doing the pre-training or are available for troubleshooting. And if I'm going to work with both parties ahead of time to make sure they understand the technology so they can fully participate, it also means paying attention to their social and personal conditions. What I mean by that is for some, like you mentioned being in rural areas, for some, the ability to join over video conferencing from their home at a convenient time that works for everyone can mean that someone doesn't lose work time, doesn't lose an entire day traveling. So it really increases accessibility. At the same time, some people don't have devices at home where they can easily have strong broadband coverage or where they can do document exchange, which means that they might need to be in a public place to participate in a mediation. Right. So here are some concrete examples where someone who wants to mediate, use video conferencing, that the ethics can provide a touchstone to increase the strength of their practice, to have them think through how to deliver the services that they'd like to deliver. And I hope, getting back to your question about how we publicize this, that those that see that it's useful help spread the word. I also think it's very important that we view them as a living document, because we've tried to keep them broad enough and thin enough that they can be translated as appropriate in different cultural settings and different legal jurisdictions in different countries. And undoubtedly, both as technology changes, but as we start to use it, we're going to hopefully hear from people who say, this would be great if you added this. It would become more relevant to my community or to my those that practice in the field as I do. And so I hope that people will feel part of the development of this process. And another way is, please join us for ODR conferences. Right. Please join iCoder, and so that we can hear your voice and you can be part of the discussion.
So helpful, Leah, thank you. I mean, just as you were talking about helping people understand the ways in which this mode of working makes a difference, I was thinking, you know, if I now see you on screen, which won't appear on the audio version, or you've got my image on the screen, you at the moment have no way of knowing whether there's somebody sitting opposite me on the sofa. And I don't know if there's someone sitting behind your screen. So it's so different from being in the same room. If we're in an actual mediation room, you can look around and say, well, who's here and who's not here? And who's here, who's not meant to be here? Unless you require me to turn my camera around and show you, scan the room, you rely on, you know, a key element of trust, don't you? That I undertake, or you undertake, that there's nobody else listening, or that I won't broadcast this mediation session to somebody else, which of course is one of the issues that you and colleagues raised in the document, which is about trust. And it's something that Colin and Amy have raised in their book on the new handshake, which is trust is so important in our negotiations, and it becomes tricky in this field. And it's one of the core drivers, I suppose, of your discussion. Can I pick up on something that you also said about participation and translation, and the small commercial break here, in that, you know, you'll be aware of our Mediator's Green Pledge, and anyone interested can simply look up Mediator's Green Pledge, which is now translated into about, last count, 15 languages. And there's the next step for these standards. I mean, and they're not, our pledge is not set in stone. This is not set in stone. But something that you alerted to, or alluded to, about the widespread interest or implications of this field, the very nature of ODR is that it crosses boundaries, crosses borders, is international. Have you encountered any particular issues at that intersection of technology, ethics, and culture when you're trying to identify the standards and principles that we need to work on?
I'm really glad you raised that, because I think that it ought to be forefront in our mind constantly. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is that the drafting committee that worked on this was 7 people from 7 different countries and 6 different continents. Wow. And we sought, of course, we're only the individuals that we are, but we sought to think through carefully when and how things could be relevant or not relevant. And then we did share it, for example, with the 50 fellows from 25 countries around the world, as well as with the iCoder board. And so we hope that we've done some vetting, but I can't imagine that we have thought through everything, which is why I genuinely believe this is a living document. And so as people translate it into their sector, their jurisdiction, their culture, their subculture in the society, for example, I think it will be important. They also might find it's not that there are pieces that are relevant, but there are pieces that are missing. And so rather than wait until years and years go by and we call information from folks and have an absence of standards, because as you mentioned before, if dispute resolution standards don't address technology, there is an urgent need to have this articulated. And then when the pandemic exploded and we had hundreds of thousands of people beginning to use technology to do dispute resolution, including the courts, again, there was an urgent need to get something out. So while we did take a considered engagement in an international cross-cultural way, I can't imagine that there's not more that can be done.
Sure.
And so I do think that it needs to permanently be viewed as a living document. Which and one of the things I find very exciting about technology is that I think there are There's something about power that gets replicated in dispute resolution processes, which is not a surprise, which is that the dominant language of the culture is usually the dominant language of who the volunteer mediators are, or often who the first language and culture of those who end up getting schooling and certified to mediate and arbitrate and serve in courts. Mm-hmm. And so we can decrease marginalization by using multilingual platforms where people can be speaking and communicating in their first language. It's just one additional avenue. I'm not saying it solves all issues around power and inequality, but I think it adds something to the dispute resolution process that is missing in the face-to-face often.
Sure. Gosh, you are the perfect person to talk about this, because what you bring in again is what we discussed right at the outset, is your very strong social justice orientation, because that becomes a driver. The technology is the impetus for these standards, but social justice and access to justice is the juice that drives it, isn't it? Yeah. It's kind of gets me thinking, this should be a very long conversation, but we will need to wrap in a little while. But can we return to just a couple of the standards? And there's 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 standards you've got there in the document: accessible, accountable, competent, confidential, equal, fair and impartial, legal, secure, transparent. Could you pick one or two of those to expand on where they fit into your thinking and the working group's thinking on the standards? Over to you to identify which ones you want to work on.
Well, I've highlighted something about accessibility already, I think, regarding multilinguality and about, I guess, what I encourage, because the standards don't provide guidance about how to live up to the standards, this is up to this is up to our community as a whole to develop more guidance documents. But I'll just give you an example that resonates for me around accessibility, which is I do encourage, and iCoder includes this in its guidance for video mediation. I do encourage that people both tell the parties ahead of time what types of technology they're going to use, get their agreement to use them, and make sure that they have access and familiarity with that. And for accountable, again, each standard is complex and has many components. I'll pull one piece out here under accountable. And it says that there must be human oversight of the determination of the relative control given to human and artificial decision-making strategies. Mm-hmm. So one way of thinking about that is, again, if someone is going to participate in a dispute resolution process, and you're going to use a tool which can be very useful when there's multiple parties and or when there's multiple issues. So I'm thinking of a large scale public policy dispute with many stakeholders and many issues. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about a divorce where there are both material resources to determine how they're divided, but also decision-making potentially about young people in the family as well. And so when is artificial intelligence going to be used to provide opportunities for, like, say, brainstorming? Mm-hmm. And when is it going to be used in a restrictive sense where it narrows options? And so talking about the way in which artificial intelligence is playing a role, and when humans lose control over that process and it gets turned over to machines can be, or to, you know, to technology, is critical, not just for accountability, but actually it falls under transparency. And I want to bring that up because we're suggesting that the standards are all necessary and that they're also interdependent, and that they should stimulate our thinking. When I'm thinking about accountability, I should also be thinking about transparency. So we can't cherry pick which standards we're going to live up to.
Exactly.
So let me see if there is another example that I could give. I guess I spoke some about competence by speaking about being able to both be competent in the technical execution of the dispute resolution technology that I'm using, and also providing access to or letting the parties know that they're responsible for becoming technically proficient in it. And then I need to consider what the ethics are if I'm not making sure that they're equally competent or familiar with using the technology. In some ways, people could say, hands off, this is up to them. And at the same time, I may not be providing an equal and fair process if someone is under-resourced compared to someone else. And this actually brings up another issue for me around risk and opportunity.
Yep.
I would argue our field has been unsuccessful in the last four decades or so to deal with repeat player bias.
Yep.
Where those that return to court again and again, or return to mediation or arbitration again and again, not to call out landlords, but as an example, a landlord who might appear a number of times with different tenants. And each time a tenant comes, they might be coming for the only time, the first time. And so we have not been able to, as a field, reach consensus on how to address these issue of inequality and repeat player privileging or bias that can happen. Technology gives us an opportunity to try to tackle that problem. But if we don't pay attention to doing that, then technology can actually foster that problem.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think just picking up on that, one of the perhaps more egregious examples is insurance companies, where the insurance companies are the repeat players. And where you've got a limited pool of mediators, they know the mediators. Mediators know the parties, the insurance, and yeah, that repeat player bias, which you try and to eliminate, but you don't. And then you exacerbate that where some of those repeat players are also more likely to be more technologically competent or better equipped than let's say the insured party or a tenant. So it's even to discuss the ethics in the way you do, it reveals the challenges that our field will continue to face, and it puts the issues out in front of us. Yeah, we're going to need to wrap in a couple of minutes, but can I ask you a practical question on this? Where can people go if, having heard this conversation, they want to look at some of the things that you and the working party, your colleagues, have produced on these standards? Is there a website they can go to?
So they are invited to explore the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution website, which is odr.info. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I'll point them towards the pages that explore ethical principles, guidance, and standards. Yeah. And also, if you go to the publication page, we have an ODR bibliography that's growing every year.
It's fabulous, isn't it?
You can download that and the framing document that they spoke about, that you spoke about earlier, framing the parameters of online dispute resolution, that document's available. All of this is available for free. We also have, if somebody is new and interested in exploring ODR for the first time, we also have archives there of the 20 plus years of online dispute resolution forums and Cyber Week. And I encourage people again to consider joining the membership organization of ICODR, and you can go to icodr.org. And the standards are also listed there, as well as guidance for engaging in the use of video for arbitration or mediation.
Wow. On that, Leah, we should wrap. And I just thank you so much. I mean, that is just, I imagine others out there listening to this in due course will find as informative and helpful. I mean, I've been involved in the field and ethics and ODR for some time, but I'm renewed in my enthusiasm for working in the field. And it's just been fabulous talking with you. So thank you for joining this conversation. It's been just a great pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It was an honor.
Okay, we'll wrap here. I'm Ian McDuff, and this has been the ICODR podcast on ODR. We'll be back with the next one soon. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODR, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about iCoder or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.